Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, hear from journalist and editor Ellie Fishman about her book Refugee High, Coming of Age in America, winner of the Studs and Ida Turkle Award. The book tells the story of a year in the life of a Chicago high school that has one of the highest proportions of refugees of any school in the nation. Ellie is interviewed by award-winning author Alex Kotlowitz. This program took place August 10th, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight for this online program of the American Writers Museum. My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director at the AWM. Tonight's program is the latest in the Jean and John Rowe series, My America, held in conjunction with the exhibit of the same name that can be seen at my-america.org. Journalist Ellie Fishman spent a year at Roger C. Sullivan High School, immersed in the lives of the immigrant and refugee teenagers who make up more than half the school's population. At the height of the Trump White House's anti-immigrant rhetoric, these students struggled with poverty, racism, and xenophobia, but dreamed of life and work and romance in their new country, as any teenager does. This year of reporting culminated in the book we're here to discuss tonight, Refugee High. Ellie Fishman is a former senior editor and writer at Chicago Magazine and teaches in the journalism department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's here tonight to talk with award-winning author Alex Kotlowitz, author of American Summer and There Are No Children Here, among many other works. Welcome to you both.
Hi. Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you both for being here.
So excited to be here.
Ellie, first of all, congratulations. This is the launch. As I tell fellow writers at this point, it's kind of at the hands of the gods. So you just have to sit back and enjoy the ride. But I got to start by saying how much I love this book. I feel like it's such a book for this moment in time. I mean, it's this beautiful tapestry of stories of these kids at Sullivan High School, you know, each of them trying to find their place, to find a home, but really in the end trying to find connections, which I think is what we're all trying to find in this moment. And given their own backstories, which we'll talk about, I just sort of, you know, you can't help but sort of admire their tenacity and fortitude. I found it actually a very hopeful book in the end. But I want to start by talking a little bit about Sullivan and what drew you there. I mean, it's this amazing place. I mean, 35 different countries represented there. I mean, you mentioned that they call it, the nickname is the Google Translates School, right? That's the nickname. And maybe you could talk a little bit about sort of what brought you to this school to begin with.
Yeah, well, I'm so excited to be here, and I can't see everyone, but I want to thank everyone for being here with me tonight. This is my first book, so yeah, it's a very exciting moment for me, and it's been many years in the making because this project started back in 2017, actually, and it all began when Trump was inaugurated in January 2017, and like so many people, I was feeling pretty hopeless and upset, and paying attention to the news. And of course, one of the first things Trump did when he entered office was announce this travel ban from 7 majority Muslim countries. And I went to a protest to protest the news. And on my way, riding the blue line to the airport at O'Hare, I was surrounded by people holding signs that said, no Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA. And, you know, just this kind of amazing energy, even on the train before we even got to the airport. And then once I arrived at the airport, there were thousands of people there chanting together and coming together as a community on behalf of these refugee families. And I wondered, you know, who are these families on the other side of the wall who are stuck in immigration right now, and where do they land in Chicago? And I am someone who grew up in Chicago. I grew up in Hyde Park. I feel like I, you know, have spent a lot of my life trying to understand the city better. And that was actually a question I had never asked myself before. And I thought, oh, if I'm asking this question, I bet a lot of people are asking this question too. And I have, without even realizing it, written about young people quite a bit in my career. I've been drawn to young people. I love how they think about the world. And like you said, they're full of hope, which is a really beautiful thing to witness. And so I wondered, where do young refugees land? And I was pretty quickly pointed towards Sullivan in Rogers Park. And I cold called the front office, and Chad Adams, the principal, invited me to come see his school. And when I walked in the doors, I was completely in awe. You know, I, like I said, I grew up here. I went to high school here. I've been in many Chicago high schools, public and private, and I'd never stepped inside a building like that before. And I knew there was a story that I wanted to tell.
Yeah, and of course, I knew Chad from Harper High when I was there doing the series for This American Life. He was the assistant principal then. And, you know, one of the things that struck me about Chad, and it certainly comes across in your book, is he's this deeply empathic man. And it's interesting. I mean, let's start by talking about him, because his own story is interesting in that he, you know, he was at Harper High during a really difficult time when there was a period there in a year when 29 current and former students were shot, seven of them killed. And as you write in the book, he was suffering from trauma. And he comes to Sullivan, which had its own difficulties.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about you and we talked about this American Life piece, because in some ways I feel like this story picks up where that one left off, and you kind of see the next chapter in Chad's life. So he arrived at Sullivan in 2013. This was his and remains his first principalship. And as you said, I think it was only once he left his job at Harper and arrived at Sullivan that he realized the impact of what he'd witnessed and the fact that he was really struggling with PTSD himself. I mean, he had lost so many students to gun violence and hadn't really processed it. And I think that made him a really incredible and unique leader for a place like Sullivan, because he really understands what it means to live with trauma, to work through trauma, and to be in an educational space, you know, balancing both these kind of personal hurts and the desire to learn. And I think he recognized himself in these kids. And that's something he says, you know, that they were a group of kids that he noticed as soon as he walked in the door on his very first day. And he decided that Sullivan should be the school for them, and really, really made that the mission for Sullivan starting back in 2013.
Yeah, he seems very sensitive to, I mean, as you kind of, were kind of very wisely focused on four kids at the school. And as you begin to learn their backstories, you begin to realize the burdens that they're carrying. And one of the things that you do really nicely, I think, is we get to know the kids for who they are before we learn about their histories. And I feel like that's really important. So they're not defined by their past and not defined by their trauma. Can you talk a little bit about, so you arrive at the school and Chad, you know, who's incredibly open, says, Ellie, please come on in. And then you spend time, I mean, one of the stories that you tell is that you visited a class and the teacher had students ask you questions to get to know you. So what were they interested in about you? What did they want to know about you?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, just to dovetail on something that you said, you know, the way I introduce the kids is also in the book, who they are that day, who, you know, how they're moving through the schools, also how I approached my reporting. It felt really important to understand kind of who they were at Sullivan, in addition to the lives that they fled and their flight stories as well. And so I wanted to come in and remain really open And part of that was making sure that the kids felt like they had agency and they could ask me questions and it could be a conversation. So when I first started reporting, which actually began with a story for Chicago Magazine back in 2017, I was introduced to Sarah Quintens, who is a main character in the book as well. And she was teaching ELL English, English language learner English at the time. And it was very clear to me that her room was like the nucleus for the EL program. And there were always kids coming in and out. It felt like a den in many ways. And so I hung out in the back of her classroom for a long time. She always like said, I was just lurking. And why was I just sitting there not talking to anyone? But I really wanted to observe and try and understand the dynamic and the ecosystem within her classroom in the school before inserting myself. And part of that was also giving the kids an opportunity to get to know me. So Sarah had a few exercises she would do for any classroom visitor. One was called the hot seat, where I was put in a chair in the front of the room with a big box of candy. And students were encouraged to ask me any questions they want. And in response, I would answer and throw them a piece of candy. So, you know, the things they wanted to know is where was I from? Was I married? That came up a lot. Did I have any kids? Also, what my family was like, what it's like being a writer, what life in Chicago is like, you know, kind of basic personal questions, just wanting to know who I was and also why I was there. That was one that came up a lot.
Well, in some ways, the same things you wanted to know about them. So, mm-hmm. So one of the people, one of the young women that we meet early on is Shahina, this remarkable woman from Myanmar. And I thought maybe it'd be nice if you could read that short excerpt when we meet her early on in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the introduction to Shahina, who is a sophomore at the time at Sullivan. Every morning on her way to Sullivan High School, Shahina passes reminders of the life she narrowly escaped. That's why she counts down the days until she turns 18. She still has 408 days to go, but that's close enough to keep the Burmese sophomore in good spirits. Though the way to school conjures bitter memories, Shahina, a refugee from Myanmar, is always relieved to be out of the house. Tensions are high at home. Shahina and her mother rarely speak, and when they do, Zakia curses her daughter's obstinacy, and school offers distraction. Inside Sullivan, Shahina walks past quotes painted next to each classroom. Maya Lin's, "The American dream is being able to follow your calling," and one from Dr. Seuss, "Think left and think right and think low and think high. Oh, the thinks you can think up if only you try." The school is a sea of navy blue lockers with the bright yellow S, Sullivan's insignia, painted above them. Below, the drab black and brown checkered floors seem to dampen the optimism advertised on the walls. The deteriorating first floor girls' bathroom, marked by large concrete slabs and rusting water pipes, stands among Shahina's most cherished spaces inside Sullivan. It's there, in the fetid room, that the 16-year-old will station herself near the mirror and take dozens of hijabless selfies. She'll spend hours each day posting photos enhanced by kitten ear filters to Snapchat, uploading close-up doe-eyed portraits to Instagram, and keeping up with ongoing flirtations with a slew of Burmese boys on Facebook Messenger. Recently, she's been talking to a Rohingya boy in Boston who claims he carries a gun and runs with a crew called the Asian Boys Gang. His profile picture boasts the group's logo, their name, with a lightning bolt for a Z. Though she's never been particularly interested in school, Shahina looks forward to starting her sophomore year at Sullivan. At school, she can watch YouTube tutorials on sunset makeup looks and catch up on social media gossip. She can make plans to watch scary movies and hitch a ride to the mall. She can drink Diet Coke and eat soggy pizza. Ever since Shahina, who cloaks her thin frame with loose clothing, began fighting with her mother, the girl refuses to eat at home. Most days, the meals provided at school are the only ones she eats. At Sullivan, Shahina can be a kid. 6 months ago, the teenager thought she'd never get that chance again. That's Shahina.
Can you talk a little bit about what drew you to Shahina? I mean, outside the fact, of course, that she's so spirited.
So in my reporting, you know, there are so many incredible stories inside Sullivan, and I wanted to make sure that I was writing about students who felt comfortable with me and who wanted to share their story. So that was kind of an initial gauge. And Shahina, as soon as I met her in the library, she started coming back around. You know, she wanted to, she was always checking in on me. She wanted to know what I was up to. She wanted to share her world with me. And that gave me a sense of the fact that she was open to this project and excited about it. So there was that. And then also I loved the relationship she had with her friends inside the building. She had a really close-knit group of friends who clearly looked out for each other and were each other's chosen family. And I really loved seeing those relationships. And then subsequently I learned that she had this amazing fierceness to her and fight and desire for independence. And she had clawed her way out of a really bad situation the year prior and was determined to carve her own path for herself in her newfound home. And I thought that was an incredible story to tell and to talk to her about. And actually, when she would ask me questions, she would ask me a lot about my own independence and how you carve that out as a woman in America. And that's often, you know, going back to what you asked me earlier, that's actually what she would ask me about quite a lot, which I also thought was really interesting.
Yeah, and she also had this remarkable self-awareness as well. I mean, a lot of the kids did, but she in particular.
Yeah, absolutely.
And did you get to know her family?
I did. So she lives with her mother and her stepfather and three younger siblings. And actually, I spent time with all of the kids' families. That was really important to me. You know, teenagers, I would say universally, don't always get along with their parents or always don't always think their parents are making the right choices. It's certainly, you know, something I remember feeling sometimes, not all the time, to my mom and dad. I recognized that in these kids, and Shahina in particular had a really contentious relationship with her mom, and so much so that I wanted to understand her mom's perspective and why she was making some of the decisions for her daughter that she was making, which from Shahina's perspective felt really draconian and abusive. And when I met her mother, I learned an entirely different story. You know, I learned that she was a person who perhaps made some bad choices, but also was fighting to survive and fighting to hold on to her culture and the world she knew, and was making choices that she, I think, genuinely thought would be best for her daughter.
And you sort of see with each of the kids how important family is and also how complicated it is. I mean, I think about the story of Alejandro from Guatemala and who comes here fleeing the gangs and is eager to see his dad, who he hasn't seen in quite a number of years. And it's not so much that they don't get along, it's that they have nothing to talk about, that they just, there's no connection. And you just sense that disappointment in him as he, you know, is so yearning to be close to his dad and can't find that connection. And of course, his story in this book, I mean, you're kind of on tenterhooks, is that, you know, he's trying to get political asylum here, which is not an easy process in this country, and also a very whimsical one as well.
Yeah, when Alejandro arrives here in Chicago, he and his dad are basically strangers.
Yeah.
And you realize how hard that is as a kid to leave your whole world behind. I mean, many of his friends by the time he fled had been killed by MS-13. That's the reason for his flight. And he lands here in an extremely difficult situation. It's not one he chose for himself. And, you know, they eventually find, over the years, find ways to connect with each other. But you feel his longing for his mother and for his family at home. You know, that that's a huge pain and loss for him. And you, that's true for all of these kids, right? This kind of tension between the world they left behind and the new lives they're building here. And so much of that plays out inside the walls of Sullivan, which is why it's such a dynamic, interesting place to be.
Yeah, I really felt for him. I mean, he's here and he's in contact with his mom and learning over time that his friends are being killed by the MS-13 down there. I've got to ask, and I hope I'm not giving anything away, but you kind of, we don't know at the end of the book whether he gets asylum. And I, rereading it, realized that his hearing was scheduled for this month.
So August 20th.
Also coming up.
Yes. Yeah. Which felt like a really long time when I finished the book, and here we are, right? Yeah, yeah. It's coming up. And he's an adult now, he has a young kid. And he's working, and, you know, he really has a built a life here.
His story is remarkable. And I think the other thing that I love about the book is, you know, reading not only about the kids, but reading about Chad and Sarah and sort of their engagement with the kids, their effort to try to embrace them and nurture them and encourage them, and to do it in a way that feels genuine to their journeys, and you sense the toll that it takes on them.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that felt really important to me was showing how hard this work can be. You know, I didn't want teachers or anyone who's worked in schools to read this book and say, oh, this is a totally Pollyannish portrayal of what school is like. This doesn't feel like reality, because the job is really hard. It's a really hard job, and they work really hard, and there are so many challenges. But I also wasn't interested in telling a savior story. And, you know, it's not about teachers saving these kids. It's about the ecosystem in which they all live and how they buoy and bolster each other together, and how it's messy and right. human in all the best ways.
Well, there's this great moment where the kids actually kind of buoy Sarah after she has split up with her husband, and they all kind of come to kind of buttress her at that moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my, I think, favorite moments in the book, because you really see the relation, how strong these bonds are inside Sullivan and how much care there is, you know, for each other both ways.
So, like, can we talk a little bit about the reporting? I, you know, one of the practical questions I had for you was just language. How did you manage? I mean, you had a, you know, there were four main characters in this book, one from Myanmar, one from the Congo, one from Guatemala, and one from Iraq. How did you manage that language barrier?
Well, translators are amazing and an interesting dynamic.
Did you bring in translators in yourself? Or?
I brought in translators myself, mostly when I was interviewing their parents. Mm-hmm. For the most part, I mean, just in terms of the like practicality with reporting, I worked with kids who had enough of a command of English where we could communicate, or we could get far enough that, you know, it required some Google Translate, going back to the Google Translate school, that, you know, we could manage without a translator, because I was in the school almost every day after a certain point. And so having a having four translators with me at all times was just not going to be possible. But I did work with translators when I visited their parents and their homes and met their families. And those translators are also incredible people. Many of them were refugees themselves and had their own experiences that I would learn as we would, you know, drive to various neighborhoods in the city. And that those were really special relationships too. And they also, in some cases, felt like they had their own wisdom to share with these kids, and were really glad to be connected with the new refugees arriving here.
Right. And that was my other question, is you were there every day?
So at first, I you know, going back to high school every day is not the easiest thing. It's amazing that high school students do it, frankly. So at first I wasn't quite there every day, but I pretty quickly realized, and honestly, I think talking to you, you were like, just go every day. And even if only one thing happens that day, that's all you need. Right. And so, yeah, I just basically started, I went back to high school and I spent almost every day inside the building, between 2017 and 2018.
And I'm curious, you know, I remember when I was working on the Run of Children here, and, you know, for the kids, they were younger than the kids you wrote about, but, you know, they in some ways could have cared less about the book. What they really cared about in the end was our friendship. That was for them what was most important. And I don't know what your experience was, because it is this kind of fine line to walk. You kind of, you know, you have this kind of quick immersion in the lives of people and this kind of accelerated intimacy and get to know people really well and come to really care about them. And so I imagine that must have happened with you and these kids as well.
Oh yeah, completely, with the kids and also with the adults in the building. Yeah. 4 years is a long time. I mean, you really become part of each other's lives, and you can't help but care about them. I mean, I imagine probably some people can spend 4 years following people that they don't care about, but I wasn't really interested in doing that. That, you know, that's a lot of time spent. I feel really close to them in particular, you know. Yeah, I feel really close to them, I should say. But I also wanted to make sure that they knew that I was a journalist and I was working on a book. And it felt important to continue to remind them of that and remind them that I have my recorder on. And actually, this is another thing you said to me early on, like, just always have your notebook out, even if you're not taking notes, just so it's like a visual cue, like, hey, I'm here taking notes, you know. I'm working. Like, we have a relationship and we're growing close, but I'm working.
Right, right. You still want to feel like you've betrayed anybody's confidence.
Right, right. So, you know, there are some really, really hard stories that come up in this book. And some of them took kids a year to share them with me. Right. And when it finally happened, I would always start saying, hey, you can always raise a hand and say, we can stop, or you don't want this to be part of the book. And I felt like, you know, I wanted to continue to encourage them to take agency and to right. tell me if it felt uncomfortable.
Right. And my guess is that for some of them, it was probably the first time they had told that story.
Yeah. If not all of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other heartbreaking stories in the book is the story, and I hope I pronounce his name right, is Belange. Is that how it's a pseudonym, I know, but.
Belange.
Belange from the Congo, whose friend is shot by a gang member here in Chicago. And you kind of sense not only the trauma of that, but that it kind of, I think, stirs up all these other memories. I mean, he grew up, if I remember right, in a refugee camp in Tanzania. And there's that moment where he's with a counselor and the counselor's trying to help him develop methods to deal with his stress and having trouble because he can't find in Google Translate what would actually translate for anxiety, for example.
Yeah, that's such a, so Josh Zepeda is the social worker who works with the immigrant and refugee kids at Sullivan. And that's such an amazing moment because, I mean, first of all, you just see Josh at work doing what he does so well, connecting with the kids in these really special ways. But there are also so many other layers going on. You know, you realize the kind of cultural gulf in how we think about trauma and anxiety, and in some ways it wasn't a concept that Belange was familiar with at all. It's not a language that is shared at home, you know, the language of PTSD or trauma or anxiety. And so it's introducing a whole concept, let alone words, a kind of understanding of who you are and how you move through the world. And Josh plays that role for many, many kids at Sullivan. And then you also get a sense of, you know, how Belenge, like so many kids, is carrying what the memories of the places he's fled and how they map onto this new life in complicated ways. And it's so much for a young person to have to navigate. And again, this is like what makes Sullivan so incredibly special. It also, to me, illustrates something that I think is really the among the most wonderful things about Sullivan, which is that, you know, they really think of themselves beyond just the classroom and curricular learning. You know, they are a space in the community. They are safety, they are shelter, they are food, they are mental health services. They are, you know, they are so many different things for these kids. And that's exactly what's kind of happening in this scene in the book, is you see how many different roles a place like Sullivan plays for a kid like Belenge.
Which is honestly what schools should do.
Yeah.
You're right that Sullivan is this kind of exemplar of that. Can I ask just personally, was it when hearing these stories, it must have been hard for you? And I know that whatever you experienced doesn't at all touch what those kids have experienced. But I'm wondering sort of how you grappled with these stories as you heard them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's painful to sit and listen to these kids and their families share these stories, and you carry it with you. You know, I'd carry it for days on end. It kind of imprints on you in a way that you don't shake. And no matter how many stories you write, and I mean, you're more familiar than probably anyone with this, you know, that you still carry that stuff in your marrow. And I had a really wonderful research assistant who helped me with some of the transcription. And I remember I kind of handed her all these tapes and she called me saying, "Oh, this is so hard. I wasn't prepared to listen to all of these stories." And we had a really long conversation about what it means to kind of bear witness and how you navigate through that. And one of the things I realized in that conversation was I was also getting to see these kids be kids at Sullivan. I got to see them, like in the excerpt I read, you know, gather in the cafeteria and watch YouTube and learn viral dances and be totally silly and flirt and play pranks on each other. And that was, you know, in some ways a counterbalance to this other part of the reporting. And so important in understanding who they are. You know, it's a fuller, more nuanced, more human picture, which is always what I wanted to tell. But yeah, those isolated moments and listening to those stories is really harrowing and heartbreaking. Absolutely.
Right. And again, I think it's one of the beauties of the book that you did do so well, is that the kids end up coming across as these kind of full, rich, complicated human beings, you know, not, you know, the way their past obviously has shaped them, but it doesn't necessarily define them. And there are these moments of joy and celebration. I mean, one of my favorite scenes is, as you mentioned, is when they're there. I think it's probably the one you're referring to, when they're distributing clothes and other items in the library, and they start listening to different songs and dance to it.
Yeah, it's the, you know, they're teenagers in the way all teenagers are, right? They all know every single word to the latest BTS K-pop hits. Like I swear K-pop is the great unifier. I believe that more than ever after reporting this book. They're watching the same videos, they're flirting in the same ways. I mean, there's so much that connects us. There's so much about us that is the same. And even if I'm not a teenager anymore, but I can, that still, you know, those experiences still feel right at the surface for me. And I recognize myself in them too.
Can you talk a bit about what surprised you the most about this experience? What was the most unexpected?
And this is more kind of outside the building, but the time I spent with these families visiting their homes, how generous they always were to me. You know, no matter how little they had, they always made me an enormous meal, like enough food for 20 people. And they would say, oh, I thought your husband was coming. But even if my husband came and he can eat, there was enough food for, you know, a full room, a feast for a full room of people. And how open and excited they were to share their culture and their tables with me. And in particular, there was one moment that really I'll never, ever, ever forget. I was interviewing Belenge's father, Tobias, and I had been told for months, like, don't expect very much. He's a very reserved man. He doesn't talk about himself. You know, he has had a really, really difficult life. And I went in expecting, I had a translator, but I was expecting that we maybe would talk for 10 minutes and we would go, and that would be it, you know, because I'm not interested in pushing people to share beyond what they're comfortable sharing. And when I arrived, he had invited close to 10 men from his church, all from the Congo, to sit and share their stories with me. And so we all sat in a circle together, and they each went around and told me their own individual stories. And then we got back to Tobias, and he started telling me his own experience of fleeing the Congo during the first Congolese war. And basically everyone in his family had been killed except for Tobias and his two-year-old daughter. And he told me about fleeing, you know, the nights he spent fleeing through the jungle, and how his daughter would cry and cry and cry. And the only thing he could do to comfort her was sing this lullaby. And he started singing me the lullaby in the middle of this room. And I just had this, it was just this, such a powerful moment. I had come in expecting so little. And here I was hearing this man sing the lullaby he had, you know, sung to his two-year-old daughter over and over again, fleeing in the middle of the night. And it was just, you know, so powerful. And I felt so privileged and lucky to help him share his story and help people understand what his experience had been like. So it's definitely moments like that that surprised me and will stay with me forever.
Yeah, it reminds me of something that Tim O'Brien wrote, which is that stories can save us. And that's sort of what it sounds like for Tobias, that the ability to finally share his stories, I'm sure, gave him some catharsis or comfort. I mean, it doesn't erase those memories, but it does, again, it's that kind of longing for connection, you know, for understanding, for empathy.
I feel really lucky that I'm able to help him do that in whatever way I can. I mean, that's why I do this work.
Thank you very much to both of you for such an incredibly insightful conversation. And congratulations, Ellie, on the book's publication. We look forward to reading it. Thanks to everyone for being here tonight. And thank you, Alex, and to Ellie especially.
Thanks, Ellie. Congratulations. I hope the book soars.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, historian and critic Leonard S. Marcus discusses his book, You Can't Say That! Writers for Young People Talk About Censorship, Free Expression, and the Stories They Have to Tell. Marcus is joined by Meg Medina, one of the authors featured in the book. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.